Hey, Dean, did you know that the farthest humans have been from Earth is the moon, but the second farthest destination? The Hubble Space Telescope.
Wait a second. What's happening here? I'm supposed to be asking
the
questions.
We're turning the tables here. It's my turn to ask the questions.
Oh, all right. I like this. Okay, so the second farthest people have been is the Hubble Space Telescope.
Which is about 100 miles beyond where the International Space Station is.
Whoa, that's pretty cool. And I mean, we haven't been back to the moon since the 70s, but the Hubble Telescope, and that was some big deal, sending astronauts to the Hubble.
Absolutely. They had to go, like you said, further into space than they had originally trained to do, beyond where the space shuttle usually orbits and beyond where the International Space Station lives in orbit.
Man, we got to go farther than that.
We're going to go farther, but the Orion spacecraft a couple years ago was a test mission to get us to the moon, and it was the farthest in the space, but we didn't have any people on that.
Oh, but man, and we're not going to go back to the Hubble telescope. That's it.
It's out there, and it's doing its thing.
Hopefully everything goes well, because yeah, we have no missions scheduled out there. But man, going up 300 miles above the Earth to work on a space telescope, that's pretty cool.
And they did that 5 times to get it right.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I like this system where you're telling me the facts. Oh, it's a lot better. Huh. I guess we'll have to note this for later. Anyway, from the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Lauren Worley, filling in for Anna Heyman. I'm the former press secretary at NASA, and Dean's the astronomer from the Cincinnati Observatory. And I'm really excited to be here because our guest today is my former boss at NASA, Charlie Bolden.
Well, this is great. It's almost like we have two guests, because I'm so glad to have you filling in here today. Thanks, Lauren, so much for doing this.
It's been so much fun.
And you have so many great stories from when you were working at NASA. I mean, you like have these behind the scenes things, and you also probably have gotten your fair share of space questions. Like, do you have some really weird ones that people always ask you a lot?
There were questions that you were guaranteed to get asked, and whether it's kids or grown-ups, the first question, number one question I always got was, how do you go to the bathroom in space?
Well, it's pretty important.
It is when you think about it. When you really start to imagine yourself living off the planet, leaving the confines of space of Earth and where you're used to being, that's the number one thing.
Well, it's always glossed over in sci-fi stuff,
they don't eat. They don't go to the bathroom.
They
don't stop to refuel their ships.
No. I mean, that would make things pretty scary, I think, if you wanted to be an astronaut as a kid, actually see what goes into the toilets. Like, so when somebody says, how do you go to the bathroom in space, what do you say?
Vacuum.
What do you mean vacuum?
I give them that first, especially if it's a kid,
yeah.
Right around 8 to 10 is the key age. But, they use essentially a vacuum for the solid waste and for the liquid waste. And it's a little bit different process for women to go to the space, go to the bathroom in space than men. But it was Sally Ride that actually got a curtain on the bathroom in the space shuttle.
No curtain?
There was no curtain before. She was the first woman to go to space, and she actually got a little a privacy curtain there.
I can imagine privacy is hard to come by in a very cramped space when
you're
weightless.
The space station's the size of a football field, so there's not a lot of places to go and be by yourself. But the bathroom is one, even in space, you would want to have some privacy.
So vacuum, huh? So that's what you need, because there's no gravity, so where is it going to go?
Exactly. It's got to be...
Man, so what's some other common questions you get?
Well,
from people?
We always get a lot of questions about water as well, and that type of thing. And I always remind
people. Is this one going to be gross too?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Don't worry, Dean. We'll let you down there. That today's coffee is tomorrow's coffee. And by that meaning, we recycle water here on Earth, but it goes through a much longer process of rain. We consume the water. It goes through a treatment facility. And in space, on the space station, the coffee that was consumed at breakfast goes through the astronaut system and then is pretty quickly recycled. I mean, the water's, the pee is cleaned and then, goes through the filtration system.
It's ready in a day for the next person?
It's not long. It's not a long process.
Oh my gosh.
So, because water is super heavy, so it's something that's very difficult to launch, because the whole cost of launches is around you know, the heaviness of what we launch up there. So we don't send up loads of new water. We gotta keep the filtration systems going and keep it clean. It's also somebody else's waste too, by the way.
Yeah, it could be somebody.
I don't know what's worse,
your own or somebody else's.
It's definitely somebody else's.
Okay, all right.
Definitely somebody else's.
So the other thing is that you've like seen, you've been around astronauts a lot, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so they have this kind of mythical persona, at least in my mind. Like, so the question I have is pretty straightforward: is are they like us, or are they better than us?
They're better than us.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid you were going to say.
I mean,
they really are
the Avengers. I mean, imagine the smartest kid in your college class. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, a classic example of an astronaut would be Chell Lindgren, who has 3 college degrees, speaks fluent Mandarin, is an emergency room doctor, and was a pilot. Right. So it's like the full package of athleticism, brains, and incredible intellectual ability. Because now more than ever, you know, when we first started the astronaut program, we were really looking for test pilots. So kind of a little bit more cowboy, cocky ability to not have fear. Now, if you're going to spend 6 months or more, and as we prepare for a Mars mission, we got to have people who are able to endure space travel for 3 years. Those have got to be people who you can put up with for that long. So the personality type's very different, and they've got to be able to solve a lot of problems on their own too without immediate contact to ground. So having doctors and people who are scientists, but they all kind of have like an arts flair too. It's always amazing.
Wait, they're artsy too?
Yeah, I mean, they're just like the full package. If you were, you know, picking out a boyfriend for your best girlfriend, they astronaut is who you would pick. They're just the whole package.
Man, I hate these people.
I know.
Oh my gosh, they're too perfect.
They're fit. They're perfect human specimens because
they're probably good looking too, aren't they?
Well, at that point, of course you're good looking. You know.
Yeah, of course.
When you've got all those things going for you. But what I've also found is a couple things. One, the astronauts that I've had the opportunity to get to know are incredibly down to earth for people who've spent so much time off the earth. Lila Melvin, who was a 2-time or played for 2 teams in the NFL and then went to space 2 times. Katie Coleman, who took her flute to space and performed with the Chieftains, which is a well-known Irish band. You know, certainly Chris Hadfield did a lot of work to with his guitar and kind of entertaining us. And, you know, that was the kind of stuff that they did to entertain themselves and got to share that with us for these long-duration missions, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, so I mean, here you are hanging out with all these astronauts, and do you feel like inadequate next to them? I mean, how would you start
to challenge yourself? You know, one of the things I noticed in working at NASA is that everyone worked out in the gym.
Okay.
Right? So, and they would be doing these like weird experiments on themselves. Like they were just natural scientists about this type of training or this type of interval training or food intake, or there was always someone doing something like that. So fitness was a major focus of many people that I worked with, which I didn't anticipate working there. And then also just the generosity of knowledge. There was never a time when I felt stupid asking a question, which might be surprising. I remember once being on the elevator with Jim Green. He's the director of the solar system. He's the head of planetary.
Wait. Director of the whole solar system?
Yeah, that's him. That's
him. I was wondering who that was.
But just our solar system, not other solar systems.
Well,
he's the head of planetary science at NASA. And he had his lunch in his hands. And I said, Jim, you know, we made some announcement that day and I really don't understand it. He got out of the elevator with his lunch and just enthusiastically is explaining to me this phenomenon. And he didn't have to. He could have just been like, look it up or read the press release or, you know, go talk to some other scientists. But that boundless enthusiasm for what they do, many, many people who send experiments to the space station spend their whole careers working on that one piece or building one scientific piece of equipment. And so they really want you to share their passion. And that's contagious. It truly is.
Well, that's really cool because, I mean, we have this ideal of astronauts, and it's so good to hear, like, that you are felt to be a better, you know, like, they're bringing us up. They're not like looking down on us from space. They're like, you all, this is what everybody can achieve if you do some hard, and that's what I think it is about mm-hmm. astronauts. I don't know. I'm fascinated by their psychology.
Well, and it's the
and
longevity of that career too, because you know, we often think about when are people in their prime. You know, professional athletes, right? Their early 20s generally, or maybe their 20s. You know, when you get to be a soccer player in your late 20s, you're at your end of your career, or professional football. But most astronauts are actually in their mid-30s or older. Katie Coleman went to did a 6-month stint on the space station at age 50. And so it's that experience that they glean over many years of their career. They're very experienced people, so it's incredible people to be around and then challenge you to be a kind of better version of yourself. The number one question I would get from astronauts is, do you have your pilot's license yet? I still don't have it, but you know, it's definitely something I hadn't considered before until I worked around all these people who flew planes.
That's the start, huh? Well, yeah. I'm glad to hear that the age is higher for peaking. Mm-hmm. It means I still have a chance.
You still got some time.
And maybe I'll ask that of our next guest if he has this opening for an aging astronomer to that can make be the best man he can be.
Absolutely.
Later on soon. Well, this is a great honor. We had recently been able to talk with Charlie Bolden back in December. This is Lauren's former boss at NASA, by the way. He retired from the United States Marine Corps as a major general and was an astronaut before becoming NASA administrator. Well, Charlie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you. Thank you so much for letting me come on.
Well, we're really excited because, I mean, to me, NASA is this, like, icon. It's like this American entity, and to talk to somebody that headed it for so long is such an honor. And I wanted to see if you could tell a little bit about what you see NASA's role as in today's world.
Well, you know, NASA is the civil space agency for the U.S. as opposed to National Security Space, which is overseen by the Secretary of the Air Force. But NASA is even bigger than that. Most people think about NASA as a space agency. It's actually a multi-pronged organization that is responsible for four big areas. One is human spaceflight, and that's done in the Office of Human Exploration and Operations. They're responsible for science, and it's divided into four big segments, Earth science, planetary science, heliophysics, or the study of our sun, and then astrophysics, the study of everything in the universe. And then the big thing, which is, although it's the smallest amount of money, but it's NASA's actual heritage, which is aeronautics research, and that's in our Aeronautics Research Mission Directorate. And then the final part is the development of new technologies necessary to enable NASA to do the things that the President, the Congress, and the American public ask us to do. And they do all four of those in incredibly good fashion for next to no money.
Wow. And well, it sounds like you take requests. Can we submit applications of missions?
And you know, the good thing that hopefully we'll talk about a little bit is NASA is now getting a lot of help from the private sector in the accomplishment of their mission. And you know, Lauren, or Rudy, as I called her, she can tell you about the time that we were together, and our mantra all the time was NASA's job was to facilitate the success of the commercial space developers, people like SpaceX and Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic and others. Our job was to do whatever necessary to facilitate their success, and I think NASA has done that in spades.
Yeah, in fact, just earlier this year, NASA announced the first astronauts who are going to test these commercial vehicles. This is the next phase from the space shuttle, and that actually, you know, these are really incredible human beings, and that actually takes me to my question for you, Charlie, which is to share with us how you became an astronaut. We know, you know, you went to the Naval Academy, but how do you get from Annapolis to space?
Yeah, I'm one, and you've probably heard me tell the story a gazillion times. I'm one who never dreamed of becoming an astronaut or dreamed of going to space. I grew up in Columbia, South Carolina, in the segregated South. And so I just, I guess, by nature, placed artificial limitations on myself. So I never, although I knew what astronauts were, that was just not something that was going to happen for a young black kid from Columbia, South Carolina. I went to the Naval Academy because I fell in love with it, watching a television program in seventh grade. And when I got there, I really struggled. I found out it was really hard. A lot of people didn't want me there, and it was not what I thought it would be. But my mom and dad encouraged me for my entire 4 years. My dad, who had been my high school football coach, actually was the one that caused me to stay the whole time. And it was when I graduated, I decided to do the first thing that I said I would never do, which was to become a Marine. I went to the Naval Academy. The only two things I knew I wasn't going to do, I was not going to become a Marine, and I was not going to fly airplanes. But I had been most impressed by a young Marine officer while I was a midshipman, and I decided to accept my commission in the Marine Corps. And I found out going through the first part of officer training, the basic school, learning to be a rifle platoon commander, that I did not like crawling around in the mud. And that kind of led me to what my wife had always recommended I do, which was go to flight school. And I went to Pensacola, Florida, fell in love with flying the first time I got in an airplane and lifted off, and then I was off to the races after that. Later decided I wanted to be a test pilot. While I was flying as a test pilot at a place called Patuxent River, Maryland, I had the privilege of meeting members of the first group of space shuttle astronauts selected by NASA in 1978. One of them was the late, great Dr. Ron McNair. And Ron, like me, was an African-American. He had a PhD from MIT in laser physics. And we met that weekend when he came up and we talked. And when he got ready to go back to Houston, he asked me if I was going to apply for the program. I told him, not on your life. And he kind of looked at me strange. And he asked me, why not? And I said, they'd never pick me. And he said, you know, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. How do you know if you don't ask? And he embarrassed me more than anything else, because my mom and dad, who were teachers, had taught me all my life that I could, my brother and me, we could do anything we wanted to do as long as we were willing to work hard and study hard and go for it. And I had placed this artificial limitation on myself that because I was from the South, because I was a black, and because there were no black astronauts up until that time, that was something I couldn't do. So when he left to go back to Houston, I picked up pen and paper, applied for the program, got invited by NASA to come down and interview, and I ended up being selected in the second group of space shuttle astronauts in 1980. So a very unlikely road to become an astronaut, but that's how I did it.
Wow. And just from somebody challenging you a little bit and not liking mud. But I do have to ask, what was the TV show that kind of got your attention back in the day? What show was it?
It was a program called Men of Annapolis, and it was about life at the Naval Academy. It was, you know, when I was growing up, there were a lot of programs about the military on television, and so I just fell in love with this place called the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, and sight unseen decided that's where I wanted to go when I was in seventh grade, and I did all in my power to get there and went through hook or crook, had to write to the president as a senior because I couldn't get an appointment from anybody in the congressional delegation in South Carolina. And I wrote to the president and said, hey, I know I'm not eligible for an appointment from you, but I need help. And never heard from him. That was President Lyndon Johnson. But within weeks, a Navy recruiter showed up at my front door and asked for me, said he heard I was interested in going to the Naval Academy. And President Johnson sent a retired federal judge around the country looking for qualified young black and Hispanic men to go to the service academies, and next thing I knew, I had an appointment from Congressman William Dawson in Chicago, Illinois, and I was off to the academy that summer.
Wow.
It's a story only one person can tell. And Charlie, you did four space shuttle missions, and there was a notable one that we want to talk about, and that's the your first mission, the deployment of the Hubble Space Telescope.
And I did. I flew four times, and I was the pilot or the co-pilot on the Hubble mission in 1990 after we resumed flying after losing Challenger.
And there were some issues getting the telescope out of the shuttle's payload bay, if I recall. There were a couple problems with Hubble, but one of the first ones, and one that I don't know if a lot of people know about, was actually getting Hubble out of the payload bay, and you had a first-hand view of that.
Yeah, we had trained extensively for more than 2 years for this mission, and the operator of the remote manipulator system, a mechanical arm, a robot arm, we call it the RMS, remote manipulator system, was Dr. Steve Hawley, and I was his backup. And we had trained, like I said, for more than 2 years, and the process was, Steve was to grapple the telescope, which was huge, about the size of a school bus and a half, just fit in the payload bay or the cargo bay of the shuttle, weighed about 25,000 pounds. And Steve reached out, grabbed the grapple fixture or the grapple fixture with the arm and began to lift it out. And all of a sudden, instead of just coming straight out the way we had trained, it started canting and rolling and doing stuff. And what the arm wasn't able to compensate for was the incredible mass of the telescope. And so I had to kind of read numbers to Steve, and it took us a little bit more than an hour to do what we thought was going to take 10 minutes. And that was, he had to go joint by joint with the arm to lift it out of the payload bay. We finally got it up and into position where we could put all of its appendages down. It had two high gain antenna that kind of fell down like two arms. That went very well. It had two solar arrays that stuck out on either side, and they rolled out like a shade in a window shade coming down on either side. The first one went out with no problem at all. The second one, we started it out, and it got about 16 inches and quit, just stopped dead, which was not good. And so that began what was almost an entire day of troubleshooting, trying to figure out what was wrong and why we couldn't get the solar arrays out. And so we were down to almost our last option, and I went down and started getting two of our crew members, Dr. Steve Hawley, Kathy Sullivan, and Bruce McCandless into their spacesuits or their EVA suits so they could go out and do a spacewalk and manually roll out the solar array. And we got the airlock down to vacuum so that it was just like out in space, and all they had to do was open the hatch and go outside. When we got an emergency call from the ground saying, stop where you are. We think we've got a solution. And it turned out to be a software problem, not a mechanical problem at all. There was a module that was to keep the telescope's solar array from ripping itself called a tension monitoring module. And a young engineer at the Goddard Space Flight Center up in Maryland, Greenbelt, Maryland, finally convinced people that if they just let him turn a 1 to a 0, the thing would work.
That's all it is.
And so it was a gutsy call on the part of the flight director and the team, because if he was wrong, we probably would have ripped the telescope, ripped the solar array and ruined the Hubble Space Telescope. So they went 3-2-1. He changed the 1 to a 0, and the solar array went out the rest of the way, and the day was saved. And so most of the day into what was supposed to have been maybe an hour-long evolution, we finally got the Hubble Space Telescope deployed, only to find out within the first week that we had this problem with its vision called a spherical aberration. And there began a multi-year saga. It took us 3 years to get a mission ready to go and do the first servicing mission on Hubble, the first of what turned out to be a total of five. And today, Hubble is a much better observatory than it was ever designed to be because of these individual servicing missions where astronauts changed out components and put in new things that were developed due to the developing technology that just didn't exist when we first took Hubble to space.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many, I'd encourage folks to look up a little more of the story of the Hubble telescope, because there's the initial parts with all this stuff that the astronauts did. There's a lot of things that, unsung things. So the final thing I want to ask you is about the future of NASA. I know we have the James Webb Space Telescope is the big project coming up that they're hoping to launch soon. What else do you see as kind of like the future things we should be looking from NASA?
Well, we just in the last month, we landed InSight, which is a robotic spacecraft that landed on Mars and is doing things like taking Mars's temperature. It's body temperature, if you will, with a probe that's going into its surface. It's measuring the wind and measuring seismic activity on Mars. We also have another satellite that's called OSIRIS-REx that's orbiting a big asteroid called Bennu. And in a couple of years after it finishes surveying Bennu, it's going to go down and actually capture a sample, bring it back to Earth, and then deposit it in the Utah desert in 2023. But in the immediate future for people, they should be looking with excitement to next month, to January, when SpaceX is scheduled to fly the first test flight on their crew vehicle. It won't have a crew in it, but it'll be an uncrewed launch, and it'll go to the International Space Station to make sure everything's working well. sometime shortly after that, Boeing will fly their vehicle on a test flight. And once those are both successful, they'll we'll start putting crews on it. So my forecast is that in 2019, the first astronauts will travel to space on two commercial spacecraft, one by Boeing, one by SpaceX. Hopefully everybody has been keeping up with what else is going on in the commercial world, because just last week, Virgin Galactic became the first commercial spacecraft to carry humans into space. It was what we call a suborbital flight, so they kind of went up into space and came right back down, about a 20-minute flight total. But that's setting the stage now to take tourists into space for suborbital flights of about 20 minutes. And those things are they're coming at us faster than we know what to do. That's not to mention a quiet supersonic airplane that NASA is developing with Lockheed Martin that will probably fly within a year or two, a test bed anyway, that will change the nature of flying at supersonic speeds such that we don't break windows and you don't get a large sonic boom, so people can travel much faster than they've ever done before without disturbing people on the ground. And then in the area, as I've already talked about, of science, we're developing the James Webb Space Telescope that's scheduled to fly in 2021 or 2022 that will revolutionize our entire understanding of the universe and dwarf the work that has been done by the Hubble Space Telescope to date, which, you know, it's hard to imagine there's anything that can be better than Hubble, but the James Webb Space Telescope is supposed to see about 100 times farther and be about 100 times more sensitive than the Hubble Space Telescope is.
I've heard you say it before, Charlie, but we live in the golden age of space exploration.
It's the golden age of space. And I you and I have said this, Lauren, the fun thing about working at NASA is we make the impossible possible, and we take science fiction and turn it into science fact, and they do that every single day.
Well, and you're still sounds like you're part of it, and I hope you didn't just give us any secrets, because there's some stuff I never heard of before. So this is we're gonna have to talk a little.
That's
off
supersonic
here.
Jet. That's,
yeah. I mean, I've never heard of a silent.
We're keeping
supersonic.
That from you, Dean.
I know.
We'll have to talk.
Yeah. So, but thank you so much for talking today. This has been a lot of fun.
No, thank you all.
Well, I used to get a lot of questions from kids and adults, too, at NASA. And I know Dean gets a lot of kids' questions from the folks who come into his classes and the youth groups at the observatory. So we've got one for today.
All right. I'm ready.
All right. We have a lunar eclipse coming up.
Yes.
So I got my observatory calendar out. What day exactly is the lunar eclipse, Dean?
Yeah, this is a big question right now because there's some websites that say it's on January 20th and other websites say it's on January 21st.
Which is it?
Well, they're both right. That's the confusing part. It depends on where you are on the Earth. And so astronomers are still kind of deferring to England and Greenwich as the official timekeeper. So the eclipse will be on the 21st, if the morning of the 21st, if you're in England and the Eastern Hemisphere. But for us in America and the Western Hemisphere, it's the night of the 20th. And this is really important because if you go out on the 21st, you missed it. So
you won't
please
see it.
Do not go out on the 20th. Well, go out on the 21st too, but go out on the 20th.
That's if you're going to stay up late.
Yes.
If you're going to make the plans.
Yes. And so this is going to be a pretty cool lunar eclipse. It's a total lunar eclipse visible all across the United States, all across of North America. And it's a Sunday night, which is okay to stay up late. But the best thing is Monday is Martin Luther King Day. And so a lot of people have off work, off school. So you have the permission to stay up late. The eclipse starts at around 10:35 p.m. That's when you first can start to see the shadow of the Earth on the moon. So when you look up and see that full moon, you'll see this little dark shadow starting to creep across the moon. And then totality is a little bit before midnight. And then goes on into the morning of the 21st, of Monday morning, and then ends up, wraps up early, about 1 or 2 in the morning or so.
So you're going to be passing out permission slips for people who need to miss work the next day?
Like anybody that needs an astronomer note, I will post it, and you can use the astronomer note, say you have permission to...
There was a celestial event last night I couldn't get to work on time.
No, you can't miss it. You can't miss it. I actually offered to do that for the solar eclipse last year.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, if you need a note to get out of work, the next day. And I wrote about 12 notes to people all around the country.
That's
and
so
I said, if your boss takes this, see if they're hiring, because yeah. I have his job there too. But yeah, that was kind of fun.
So what occurs during the lunar eclipse? Does the moon turn red? What?
It does, yeah. So the it's often called the blood moon, which I really don't like that term. It's like something the Hollywood folks wanted to make it look scary
or something.
Or the
ancient Romans, you know.
No, they never called it that. They just said it was, you know, it's an eclipse. That's what it is. Oh. But that's what it's now called, is the blood moon. And that's because the moon actually does turn this eerie shade. Now, it's you never know exactly what color it's going to turn, because it could be gray, could be orange, could be red. It depends on what's going on Earth, actually. So the Earth is getting in between the sun and the moon, and the Earth's shadow is being cast on the moon. But a little bit of light still gets to the moon. It passes through our atmosphere. So it's like it bends through the atmosphere and turns different colors. So the color you're seeing on the moon is actually all the sunrises and sunsets of Earth on the moon. It's pretty cool to see that color. And if we have more atmosphere, like if there's more volcanic eruptions that have been happening, then it's going to be darker in color. If there's less stuff in the atmosphere, then it's going to be lighter in color. So we never know exactly what it's going to look like.
The moon and its amazing technicolor.
Yeah.
And shadow cast.
And yeah. I mean, if I was to give advice, the best times to see the eclipse is my number one time is to see when it starts. So right at 10:35, when you can start to see the shadows start to creep off, that's the best. And then second best is the different colors when it's in totality. So around midnight, and you just watch it for a few minutes, and then you turn away and you can talk to friends for a bit, and then you turn back and it's a different color. It's just a slightly different shade.
Whoa.
And I just love how it just changes ever so subtly throughout the eclipse. So
do I need any special equipment to see this?
Nope. This is the easiest one.
We don't
to
have to
see.
Get those eclipse glasses?
No eclipse glasses or anything like that. So this is all just visible to the naked eye. You don't need telescopes. You don't need binoculars. You just need clear skies. So check your weather forecasts and see. Hopefully, it'll be clear on the
January
night of
January 20th.
January 20th. You got 20th.
That's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to my old boss, Charlie Bolden, for joining us. It was great catching up with him, Dean.
We really appreciate you listening and would love to hear from you. You could drop us a note with topic or guest ideas or questions about space on Facebook or Twitter, or email us at lookingup@wvxu.org.
Parents, we hope you'll share Looking Up with your kids and send us any questions they may have. Or if you have questions, we want to hear those too.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts, and give us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. If you're new to Looking Up, you can always find all of our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
Our theme song and additional music is by Why. That's W-H-Y question mark. From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks for listening. I'm Lauren Worley.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.